a teaching and a research program that shapes and defines what we do and how we do it. But beyond the academic program, very broadly defined, a curatorial responsibility and a university librarian responsibility and a director of special collections responsibility is to collect for the field, for the discipline, for the world. I don't collect just for my Stanford constituents. We have visitors globally every day. And so how do you build a research collection with that kind of context? You have to view the world as tiny, and it is. And so that's why we travel. The research collection responsibility for the book arts, for artist books, is a weird one, because I don't think that libraries have assumed the responsibility that they should for having research-level collections, collections that are in-depth. A lot of libraries, especially the smaller ones, collect samples of things. Well, at Stanford, and at the Harvards, and at the Berkeleys, and at the Yales, you have to collect for the future, for research, for teaching, and you can't do it with one copy of a book by Carolee. And by the way, I do have Carolee's book, and I do have Sam's work. I got a sneak preview of Sam's book this past Thursday before Codex started, and within 10 minutes, I said, I want it, I need it, I have to have it. Don't tell me what's going to cost me, but just make sure I have a copy. And we will, we have. I collect Carolee comprehensively, I collect Sam comprehensively, I collect Peter Koch comprehensively. We collect a lot, and it's shaped and defined by the program. The responsibility that libraries have is an immense one, because we collect what is evidence of our culture. And the artist book is that. And so for libraries to shun that responsibility because a book costs $2,000 or $1,000 or $50 is something I have a problem with. And I think that the state that libraries are in today, because of budget cutbacks and because of financial crisis and because of the digital age, I don't think those are reason to not collect the book arts or the artist book. And I think people like me have to find creative ways to continue doing it. And so, you know, Stanford has shaped and defined me. I've been there for 33 years. I've seen a lot. I've been through several directors, several presidents, several provosts, several directors of collections. But through all of them, they have all in some way been supportive of what I'm trying to do, because there's a big vision that teaching and research is important. And so the book arts, people talk about, well, should a library be collecting this material or should it be in the museum? Well, the museums, I'm afraid, aren't going to do it. They'll do some, but they're not going to do it for the level that we have, I think, a responsibility for. The challenges are, you know, space. Stanford has finite space. Space is shrinking in the middle of campus. And so most of the major research libraries have remote shelving facilities, or remote, I don't like the word storage, but remote shelving facilities. And so with Mike Keller's leadership, Stanford has built two modules of a major, you know, remote shelving facility that can accommodate some 6 million or so volumes. And he fought for that space and for that capacity because, in spite of the digital age, people have not stopped printing books in paper. And so where do we put them? They can't fit on campus. And the whole point is not to not have them be in the middle of campus, but the whole point is to have the capacity to have them and to page them within 24 hours for teaching and research uses, period. And so I don't care if my book is in Livermore, 50 miles away, because I can have it for whomever needs it tomorrow morning. And it's in a state-of-the-art facility. And I don't care that it's only for a book. At Stanford, we're collecting the archives of people who produce books. And so we have Charles Hobson's archive. We have Peter Koch's archive. We have the Yola Bowling Press archive. So quite apart from individual books or collecting the, you know, the comprehensive output of a particular printer or designer or an artist, that's one thing. But then what do we do with the archives? I know that Library of Congress with Mark, and you know, he acquired Russell Murray's archive last year, year before. That's important because of teaching and research needs. And so these, as you listened to Carolee earlier this morning, books don't just happen. And so people have to understand what the artist has gone through to create what they have created and to print and publish what they have published. And when you hear these kinds of stories, and I think that you're going to hear these kinds of stories only at places like Codex, you understand the importance of the book. When I first started collecting in the book arts, I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. And there were no journals, per se, that would be guides to what to acquire. And so I had to find a way to learn the field, if you were, fairly quickly. And I had to learn the economics of it, and I had to learn the personalities and the politics of it. And when people would come knocking on my door, you know, selling their books or showing me their books, I had to find a way to verify, if you will, their importance. It's a curatorial responsibility to know what you're getting and to make sure that you're getting what should be acquired. That was really difficult because the book arts aren't part of the book trade in the same way that trade books are part of the library world. And so the conferences and the book fairs that have existed up until Codex have been relatively small, pretty regional, geographically isolated in the sense that they weren't international in scope. And so one day over these infamous martinis that Peter has talked about, he was talking about this problem. He said, "Roberto, what can we do about it?" And I said, "Well, you know, if we had a conference, a congress, a symposium, a book fair, where you had the collectors, private collectors, institutional collectors, where they could meet each other and learn from the artists themselves what they're producing and why," I said, "I'd be happy to help." And so Peter talked more about his vision for Codex, and we talked about it more with Susan, and we dragged Carolee into the discussion, we dug Duke Collier into the discussion, and we came up with, let's invent a Codex type thing. And I'm not quite sure where Codex, you know, the title came from. It was probably from Susan. Yeah, Susan. But anyway, the point was, I needed, very selfishly, a mechanism to learn what was happening in the field, not just in my country, but internationally. And so the whole point was to, let's bring people together, let's make it affordable, let's make it educational, plus the symposium part of the book fair, where you learn something about what's being done where. And I think, really importantly, I said it has to have a social component. It has to have the cocktail party. It has to have the gala dinner or a gala lunch or whatever. But you have to have a mechanism where it's not just business, where you become friends, you become cohorts in crime. And so over time, that's what happened. And all of a sudden, yesterday, day one, and within 4 hours, Codex Book Fair 5 had, I think, 1,200 people, 1,100 people come through the door in the middle of a messy storm. That's important. And the challenge, I think, that I have now, and I think the challenge that institutions like mine, the big research libraries, the challenge is, look at all the material that's at the Codex Book Fair. How much of that's going to end up at Stanford, at Harvard, at Yale, at Bancroft, at UCLA, at the Library of Congress? None of us could buy it all. That's not going to happen. We don't have that kind of money, in spite of the fact that we're big, bad, rich institutions. We could not do it. And so, curatorially speaking, how do we sift through that to acquire the stuff that's really important? How do we say no? How do we collaborate? In the hallways yesterday, three people from the Bancroft Library walked up to me and said, "Roberto, are you going to be buying this book? Because if you are, I won't, and I'll buy this book." And I said, "You know, that's what we should be doing, because between the three of us, or the four of us, or the five of us, we're only a bridge across, you know, the water from each other. If we can buy more rather than all buy the same, that makes the region a much richer place for research and teaching." And so we do that pretty routinely. I suggest that maybe we should be doing that nationally, because I can't do it all. Harvard can't do it all. Yale can't do it all. It's just not, you know, it's not going to happen. So how do we divvy up the book arts world for contemporary production to make sure that at least in this country, we have the best of the best and then some? In the old Research Libraries Group days, they had a program that was called Primary Collecting Responsibilities. ALGs, I guess was it called? Right? And they divvied up parts of the world, the major research libraries, and they assumed responsibility as the single primary institution to collect relatively comprehensively in a particular field or a particular area. Maybe we should do something like that for the book arts. Maybe we should have Stanford collect Peter Koch, period. Maybe we should have Harvard collect Carol Lee Campbell. I don't know. But divvying up, you know, what's being produced so that it is in the libraries, it's in their collections for the future, for research and teaching and just reading, I think is important. And I think if we don't do that, we're going to end up with very similar collections, with very small collections compared to what the world production output is. And it numbers in the thousands. And the evidence of it is at the book fair that you're going to see earlier this afternoon. I don't know how many books are on display. There's probably several thousand, right? You know? And there's some of the best out there. Go by Russell's table, go by Sam's table, go by Carol Lee's table, go by Peter's table. Pick any of you. There's 180-some tables. Go to any of them. I could drop multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars today if I had.
Hoping.
But so anyway, that's a challenge. And quite apart from that kind of challenge of actually identifying and selecting the material that we're going to have in our collections, at the panel that we had at Stanford a couple of days ago, there was a whole discussion about the intellectual access and the cataloging of artist books. Interesting. Should we have the book have an entry primarily under Peter Koch and not the poet whose work he's interpreting in his new book form? Or should it be under the poet? Or both? Or what do we do? Digitally, Sam was talking about how he produced his book. Where are the digital files? Quite apart from the scroll. Where are the plates? Should somebody have them? Should I have? Yes. So that's, you know, those are things that I think are important. And I think the archival component of collecting for the book arts is something that we haven't really thought about collectively in any serious way. But I think that we should, and I think that between, you know, 10, 15 major institutions, we can make a major dent in having these archival collections be part of the global community of libraries. I think it's a responsibility that we should step up to. It's not cheap. Quite apart from acquiring them is going to be the issue of processing them and having space to house them, and then having the facilities and the capacity to provide the public service and the physical access to things, to have the capacity to lend these materials for exhibitions. Stanford has a relatively modest but very active exhibitions program on our own campus. We collaborate with museums on our own campus. We've also collaborated with museums all over the world. The Met has borrowed stuff from us. The Tate has borrowed stuff from us. LA County Museum of Art has borrowed material from us. We happily lend. We own the materials, but we feel that we're more a caretaker than an owner. They belong to us, you know, in a very broad sense. I think that's important too. We publish catalogs because of it. Stanford has been a major sponsor and supporter of Codex from day one, both financially and through my time and some of my staff people's times. We have hosted, just the past 2 days, a collegium that's the first ever. But that learning process was important for me as a director of collections or special collections and as a curator. I don't know everything. People, you know, things happen new all the time. And so how do I maintain my knowledge? How do I maintain my friendships, my business relationships with people? Through these kinds of things. And if we didn't do it, who would? And so we've assumed a responsibility that's a leadership responsibility for pushing that envelope, for continuing to have ways to learn from each other, for continuing to have friendships. Most of the people in this room are friends. Most of you I met at a Codex. Most of you, when you knock on my door or send me an email or send me a text or send me your prospectus, you know that I'll look at it. You know that I'll pay attention to it. A lot of you I'll be collecting. A lot of you I'll be buying from. Well, that little connection didn't just happen. You know, if I would have gotten something in the mail, I didn't know how to put a place or a name to a face, it's different. And so having a mechanism for doing that, for learning, for teaching, lets us be better supporters of teaching and research across the board as well. I have a pessimistic position on libraries that's bothersome to me, but I'm going to share it with you. I think that in this country, you're going to see 10, maybe 15 research libraries that survive, that have the capacity to do what I'm talking about. I think most of the others are not going to have the financial resources, are not going to have the space, the staff. And so I think collecting at a research level is going to be much tighter. And so that means that those 10 gorillas, these 15 gorillas, have to find a way to work together in some special ways. And that's not to negate smaller libraries or smaller institutions from having a role at all. They can collect, and happily so. But I think to collect for that research level, it's going to require, you know, the big 10 or so major research libraries in this country to collaboratively have a strategy for making sure that we have it, for making sure that it's cataloged, for making sure that it's available, for making sure that it's housed properly. The whole conservation issue and the whole housing issue. When we buy artist books at Stanford, it's rare that I don't consult with our conservation lab people. Rare. And most of the curators at Stanford know that if they're getting something that's a little bit weird, that has weird, you know, we call them and they come running and they tell us what best to do to make sure that we can take care of that material and preserve it. It's a major factor. Having information about the collections available, you know, in our electronic catalogs, and having, we're inventing this new thing called, what's the Photoshop thing for the online exhibits? Spotlight.
Spotlight.
Curators at Stanford can now do their own online exhibition catalogs for all practical purposes. So if I wanted to do and feature all of Peter Koch's work digitally, I personally could, and it would take me a couple days. That capacity to do that for a curator is pretty phenomenal. And I'm working with four or five curators now. They want to take a collection from Special Collections that they had a responsibility for, that they've helped creating a finding aid for, that they've helped in shaping the cataloging of it for, but now they want to share more of that content digitally, and we can. And I think it's only going to beget more use of the real thing, but making it known, making it accessible, happens because we have the internet and we have digital capacities. And we have, in fact, a digital archive and a digital library that's really, in every sense of the word, a counterpart to the analog library. And I would argue that the backlog for processing digital archival collections is as big as my backlog for processing analog collections, which I think is pretty interesting. They're now in the same boat that we are. And the point is, backlogs don't bother me. I'm actually very proud of them because it means that we have the capacity to collect before it disappears. And so, challenges, collecting the modern book, you know, 1600 forward, contemporary book. We can argue about what an artist book is, we can argue about what modern is, we can argue about what a book is. But at the curatorial level, you know, we can't prescribe to an artist what to do or how to do it. When Sam creates something, I look at it, and it's my job to figure out how do I have that in my library. Because he's an important artist, and my students, and my faculty, and my academic program need to have access to that material. And so, Codex is part of that answer. Codex, you know, is a marketplace for private collectors, for institutional collectors. It's the biggest one in the world now for this genre. It's absolutely fun. You know, everybody sees everybody. Everybody goes to the cocktail parties and the lunches and the dinners. These symposia, I mean, how many of you knew the story behind Carolee's book before this morning? I did, because I've seen it, but, you know, there's a handful of us, five or six people. That story is phenomenal. How many of you knew the story behind Sam's book? Or that it even existed yet, because it's relatively new? Very few of us. Sam can visit me, Carol Lee can visit me, but when they come here and they share that to 200 of you, that's better than just coming to my office. And I think Codex has assumed the responsibility for having that happen. So I'm very proud to be part of Codex and have not stopped wanting to be part of it. Money, people worry about money. So do I. But people ask me, Roberto, what's your budget? And I said, well, you know, I can tell you what the budget is, but I think you're asking the wrong question. What you should ask is, how much money is spent on materials that go into special collections? Or better yet, what's the dollar value of material that come to special collections that you didn't buy, that somebody gave you? It's in the millions. My budget isn't in the millions. The value of what we acquire is in the millions, multiple millions. It's important for research and teaching, and again, what we collect and how we collect it is shaped and defined by that program. And so we consult regularly with faculty. We want to meet all the incoming graduate students. They're going to be there for 4, 5, 6 years. We try to hire them to work in our collections, especially if it corresponds to their area of study. These people finish their PhDs, they become professors, they go off and they teach. We have students who have worked in my library all over the country. They send their students to Stanford to use the same collections that they worked on or that they help process and collect. So it becomes that old invisible college that we talked about back in the 60s and 70s, I think is very much alive. I think Codex is a part of that kind of a thing. And so I feel like I'm giving a sermon rather than a talk. But this little building feels like, you know, like a church. I was going to have you all standing when I came in, but then I thought, no. I remember once when I was an altar boy way back when, and I had to light the candles on the altar, and I was wearing my cassock, but I didn't have that little white shirt on top. So when I walked out, the whole church stood up. And I thought, huh.